Good stuff. Well, we're 5 days away from Solomon City beginning. You've probably heard us mention Solomon City a number of times tonight. Basically, it's a mission that we're involved in on the Bempton Estate, which is the estate right behind King's Cross Station. We're partnering with a number of other churches, including the Barnsley Parish, the Ethiopian Church, King's Cross Baptist Church, London City Mission, a number of others too. And basically, we're going to serve the estate in as many ways as we can to demonstrate God's love to them. So gardening projects, decorating projects, barbecues, fun days, kids' activities, bouncy castles, a tea party for the elderly, loads of different stuff as a way of saying, look, God cares about you, wants to be in relationship with you. And we're really, really excited. But before we engage in this mission, 5 days away, I just want to share a few thoughts about how we might be motivated to serve wholeheartedly so that next Thursday, we can almost have the mindset of we're all in. We want to serve you recklessly, which is part of our vision at KXC, isn't it? To recklessly give ourselves away to God, each other, and the people of King's Cross. So that's the plan for the next 25 minutes or so. I want to kick off with the question then. The question is this: what motivates the mission of God? What is it in God's heart that drives him in his mission to redeem and restore a broken world and a broken humanity? You know, what drives the mission of God? Because we can talk about what motivates us in mission. That would actually be quite productive. We don't have time for it. But my guess is there would be a range of things. Some would say, well, I'm driven by duty. Obligation. You know, as a Christian, aren't I meant to do X, Y, Z? Others would say, I'm driven by joy. I want to serve and I'm just desperate to tell more people about Jesus. We're driven by different things, but I want to ask the question, what drives God in his mission? What would move God to do what he did in terms of wrapping himself in human flesh, if you remember the story of Jesus, being born, remember, at the very bottom of the social ladder, in a stable surrounded by animal excrement. He would then live his life knowing rejection, being abandoned by his own family, being hated and despised by Pharisees. Many people would be in opposition to him. He lived life under Roman persecution. I mean, these are painful things. And then would die a brutal death, in which he stripped naked and flogged within an inch of his life, and then would have to carry his cross up this hill as people spit at him and mock him, and they put a crown of thorns on his head and they hang him on this cross with a placard saying, King of the Jews. You know, that's kind of quite funny, isn't it? And he would die a brutal death where eventually he suffocates. And that's kind of the end of the story, at least for the moment, until the resurrection comes. Goes through all these horrific things. What would drive God to do that kind of stuff? And if you know the story, you'll know that the last week of Jesus' life is known as the Passion. You might have seen the film. Anyone seen the film Passion of the Christ? Now, Passion is a Greek word. It literally means to suffer. That's all it means, to suffer. So when someone says, oh, I'm really passionate about dot, 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 they're basically saying, I so believe in that cause, I'd willingly suffer for it. I'm so passionate about my job. In other words, I'd sacrifice a lot for the sake of my career. I'm really passionate about my kids. In other words, I'd do anything for them. I'd willingly suffer for their sake. I'm passionate about my football team. In other words, I'd willingly travel the length of this country, pay good money to go and watch them play even if they lose. I would willingly suffer for the cause. That's what it means to be passionate. So the question is, what is God passionate about? Because we know he suffered incredibly. Why? What drives that passion? And the answer is you do. And I do. He's passionate about you. He's passionate about me. He's passionate about humanity. My experience is that we love the things that are valuable to us. The more valuable they are, the more we love them. And I think that's true of God. You know, if you look in Scripture, what's the thing that's potentially most precious to God? The answer is you and me and our fellow humanity. He cares so deeply, and it's that love that drives him to suffer. He's passionate about you, me, fellow humanity. So the question is, why is he so passionate about humanity? Like, why are we worth so much to him? And to answer that question, we're going to look at a very brief text. Genesis chapter 1, which is the intro to the story, where we begin to get a glimpse as to how God sees humanity. So you ready for it? This is Genesis chapter 1. I'll read it to you. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea, and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves along the ground. Now, there's a number of phrases in there which are really important. One of them is rada, a Hebrew word rada, means to rule. It says twice, you are to rule over. So just clock that one. Ruling is a key phrase within this text. The second key thing is that it uses this phrase, image and likeness, a couple of times. Now, this text was written in maybe the 5th or 6th century BC. So we're going back centuries, you know, thousands of years. And ever since it was written, and we have no idea who actually wrote it, so ever since it was written, theologians, you know, thinkers have been asking the question, well, what did the author mean when he describes humanity being made in the image and likeness of God? What do these two terms, image, likeness, Hebrew terms, tselem and demut, what are they trying to actually point towards? And hundreds of books have been written just trying to answer that question. What does tselem and demut mean? What does it mean to be made in the image and likeness of God? Literally hundreds of books on the subject. So I could never summarize hundreds of books that I haven't actually read on this subject. But I could summarize the one or two that I've partially read. So I want to mention three things about what it means to be made in the image of likeness of God, what it means to be human. And the reason I mention these three things, I believe if we grabbed hold of them and they actually began to transform us, it would shape how we engage in mission. So rather than being driven by duty or obligation or aren't I meant to share my faith, isn't that what Christians do? Rather than those things driving us, suddenly we'd be driven by the same things that drive the mission of God. So here's three things we need to know about this image and likeness language. Number one then, image and likeness is the language of sonship. Image and likeness is the language of sonship. So listen to this. Fast forward from Genesis 1, just a few chapters. Genesis 5 verse 3 says this, talking about Adam. When Adam had lived 130 years, I think we'd agree it's pretty good innings, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. That's the only other place, I think, in the Old Testament where you find image and likeness together. And it's done so in the context of talking about Adam having a kid. So in other words, people can see that Adam's had a child, Seth, and when they get to meet Seth, they're like, oh, Seth's so beautiful. Adam, he looks just like you. Chip off the old block. In other words, Seth resembles in some way his own dad, Adam. So it's talking about a father and son relationship. You know, so when God says, let us make humanity in our own image and likeness, he's essentially saying, let's have kids. Let the love that's contained within the Trinity, let it overflow so that we have children that we can share in relationship and love. That's why God's referred to throughout Scripture as the Father. He's the father of Israel, he's the father of Jesus, he's the father of Abraham, and he's the father of Isaac, and so on and so forth. He's our father. If you read Luke chapter 3, there's this section within it which is basically the genealogy of Jesus. It's an incredibly dull read. So if you're struggling to sleep at night, Luke 3, the second half, is absolutely for you. And it basically lists the lineage of Jesus. It starts by saying Jesus was the son of Joseph. Joseph was the son of, can't remember his name, he was the son of dot, 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 and he was the son of dot, 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 and he was the son of dot, 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 and it goes on and on and on, 76 generations. It's a lot of reading, by the way. So 76 generations, and as you come towards the end of the generations, it says, and he was the son of Seth, and Seth was the son of Adam, and Adam was the son of God. He's the father of us all. What does that have to do with mission? Some of you might be thinking, that's relatively uninteresting. What's it got to do with mission? It was simply this. God cares for humanity because they're his kids. Because they're his kids and he can't help himself. And he can't help himself. You know, here's a story that might illustrate this a little bit. When I was 8 years old, I remember a moment in the school playground. We're playing in the playground at lunchtime. You know, what do kids play at that age? Probably a bit of football. Bit of kiss chase, thrown in for fun, throwing a few marbles, maybe a couple of geeks in the corner with their cards, playing trumps or whatever. So you've got these different games going on, but then if a fight breaks out, you know what happens, because you went to school, is my guess. Suddenly a chant begins, fight, fight, fight. It starts with two or three, but there's a little bit of energy and excitement that two people are fighting in the playground. And suddenly a circle, you know, gathers around, it gets louder, fight, fight, fight. People get more and more excited, and you see people from distant corners of the playground running to join the circle, and then suddenly you've got pretty much everyone in the playground gathered in a circle saying, it's not low, is it? Because everyone's 8 or 9, so fight, 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 fight. And it gets louder and people get more excited, and I got to the crowd pretty late on, so I'm like, who's in the middle? And you're asking questions because I was short, couldn't see anything. Who's in the middle? Who's winning and what's happening? And I start pushing my way to the front of the crowd. I want to see what's going on. As I get to the front, it's my older brother in the fight, my brother Tim. And immediately I'm thinking, like, Tim, what are you doing? Because the people in the crowd might not know this, but I know this, and you're a wuss and you're about to get your head kicked in. And he'd started this fight with a guy called Drew Weatherspoon. I remember it clearly. This is like over 25 years ago, but the memory's like lodged there. I can't move it. So Drew Weatherspoon, he was one of these like really big guys, like at the age of 10. Puberty's almost certainly kicked in already, like defying all laws of nature. But suddenly he's like big and he's hairy and he's in a fight with my older brother and he's pummeling him. And I'm feeling a number of things. One of them is this kind of panic of like, you're going to tarnish the Hughes family name. Because at this moment in the playground, it means something to be a Hughes. It means you're okay at football. When it comes to kiss chase, you can handle yourself. You know, when it comes to marbles, you're pretty devastating with the marbles. And when it comes to top trumps, you know the cards inside out. So being a Hughes kind of means something in the playground. And Tim, you're about to ruin all of that because you're getting your head kicked in. You're bringing shame on the family name. So there's a level of panic as to my reputation. But the other thing I'm thinking is like, this is my brother. This is like flesh and blood, someone that I love, and he's getting beaten up. And I'm watching him, and Drew's standing there big and strong and literally throws in a right hook and floors my brother. And my brother, well done to him, he gets back up and goes for more. He throws a couple of fists himself, completely misses Drew, by the way. And it goes on, and I know that this is going to end messily. So I've got like two options really that came to mind. One is that I scream for help. I'm like, help! But everyone's shouting, fight! Fight so loudly that any screaming I do is not going to go above the scream, the chanting of a fight. Second option is I step into the middle of the circle and try and give Drew, you know, a little taste of his own medicine. But then I realise, like, I'm 8 years old and I have no idea what I'm doing, and he's a massive, massive guy, so that's not going to happen either. So I feel this sense of paralysis and panic. And I'm kind of joking about it, but in the moment I genuinely did feel terrified. Because I thought, Tim's not going to be able to handle himself. This guy, Drew, looks pretty angry. Like, what's going to happen now? I felt like, as much as I can explain, terror, I guess, as an 8-year-old kid. And then basically something bizarre happened. The fight came to an end. Not because teachers ran in and separated it. I'm sure they were back in the school just watching, having fun over their coffee. Oh, look at this one. You know, Tim v. Drew. Who would you put your money on? So that was probably happening in their staff room. But suddenly this guy called Stephen, who was in the top year at the school and was probably the only other guy that had also started puberty, so was one bigger than Drew, suddenly stepped into Tim's defence, threw a fist at Drew, floored Drew, and that was the end of the fight. And to this day, Tim still claims that he didn't lose that fight, that he was holding himself, that he was going to come back stronger in the second half, which is embarrassing because he was totally getting nailed. But the point of the story is, I felt panic. I felt this sense of like, this is someone I love who's getting hurt, and that's causing me hurt. That's natural, isn't it, when it's flesh and blood? Now, if that's true of my older brother Tim, and those emotions are pretty strong, if that's true of my older brother Tim, imagine my emotions for my own kid. Like, we've got two children, two boys, 4 and turning 2. We've got a little girl who arrives next week. If anything happened to one of those, if I saw one of those getting really badly picked on or beaten up, imagine what I'd feel within, if there's any parents in the room. You know how protective you are over your children. It's frightening. Like, sometimes I think, what if something happened, what would I do? I'm like, I'm terrified at the thought of what I might be capable of, because the feelings of protection are so strong. You know, and I meet mums who sort of like, who were worrying about their kids, and they heard that one of their children got called a nasty name in the playground, which is a fairly minor thing, but they're thinking, right, I'm going to go and see the head teacher. And I'm going to lay it out pretty straight to the head teacher, that if it happens again, we'll be lodging a complaint with X, Y, Z. And you get this kind of like overly defensive thing going on. If that's true of us, and we're broken as humans, wouldn't that be true of God? Like, how do you honestly think God feels about someone that's, you know, suffering domestic violence on the Bemerton estate right now? Do you think he'd be cool with that? No, I think he'd be livid, and I think it would break his heart. How do you think God would feel about, you know, the isolated elderly people that haven't had any community for maybe years, maybe decades? They live in their flat in isolation, like terrified of the estate around them. Do you think God would be cool with that? No, I think it would break his heart and it would make him livid. How do you think God feels about the young guy who's not had a consistent mum and dad figure around, and suddenly when he hits around 7 or 8, he's given a knife and an opportunity to be in a gang, and he takes it because he's desperate to belong? How do you think God feels about that? And my hunch is, like, livid, that it would absolutely break his heart, because these people are his kids. And if you're a loving father, you can't help but love your kids and be protective over your kids. And when your kids are under threat, there's a sense of injustice you begin to feel. You know, it became pretty popular recently, or it has become pretty popular, to sort of steer away from the idea of angry God. Like, we don't like angry God because we like a nice God who's just loving and does nice things for his people. And that's right, and that should always be the emphasis, the love of God. God is love, not just he's loving. He is love. But for God to be love and for him to be loving, he must get angry, right? He must get angry. This is what Tom Wright says about it. He says, the biblical doctrine of God's wrath is rooted in the doctrine of God as the good, wise, and loving creator who hates anything that spoils, defaces, distorts, or damages his beautiful creation. And in particular, anything that does that to his image-bearing creatures. If God does not hate racial prejudice, he's neither good nor loving. If God is not wrathful at child abuse, he's neither good nor loving. If God is not utterly determined to root out from his creation in an act of proper wrath and judgment the arrogance that allows people to exploit, bomb, bully, and enslave one another, he's neither loving nor good nor wise. If God is insanely loving, which he is, when he sees his creation and his sons and daughters getting abused, raped, you know, mistreated, do you think that makes him livid? I think it does. So what has that got to do with our mission? What's that got to do with us getting out there and demonstrating his love? Whether it be in your workplace, in your university, with your family, or like Son City, a mission to the Bemerton Estate. You know, what does it mean for that? Simply this, that the people we're trying to reach, they're God's kids. They're his sons and daughters. And his heart for them is so passionate. He'd willingly suffer for their sake. He has suffered for their sake. And if they're God's child, a son and a daughter, and you're God's child, a son and a daughter, that makes you brothers and sisters, right? If you do the maths, it's pretty straightforward maths, isn't it? They're your brothers and sisters. And you'd never let your brother and sister live in squalor and in complete poverty and be grieving alone and living alone. I would never let my brothers live like that. I just couldn't do it because they're my family. So how is it that we can let people live just down the street, just around the corner in complete squalor? That they're grieving and in all sorts of pain, but they're doing it completely alone. How can we let that happen? And the answer is because we don't care that much. Because we don't actually see them as brothers and sisters. Now, I'm just being brutally honest, but that's kind of the reality of it. And if we could understand that to be made in the image and likeness of God means that we're sons and daughters of God, and they're sons and daughters of God, and therefore we're brothers and sisters. And as we take responsibility for one another, that's when we begin to see human flourishing. So our mission in Psalm City, your mission, your workplace, is to treat those around you like brothers and sisters, and to look after them and love them in the way that you'd love your own family. Second thing then, image and likeness is the language of royalty. Image and likeness is the language of royalty. You see, in Genesis 1, this term that I mentioned, rada, means to rule. That's language you'd use of kings. Kings rule over nations, right? So basically this text is saying to be made in the image and likeness of God means that you have a royal identity. In the ancient Near East, basically, they had this belief that only the king of a certain nation was made in the image of God. So you can see this in the worship of the Romans. They somehow believed that Caesar, the emperor, was made in the image of, I think, Venus. So somehow the sons of the gods, and therefore was in some sense divine. So the Roman people would worship Caesar, and they would proclaim each day, Caesar is Lord, Kyrios Kaiser. And we see that with the Babylonians. They had this belief that the king, Nebuchadnezzar, was in some sense divine. They'd worship him. The Canaanites did the same. The Hittites did the same. All these nations in the ancient Near East believed that the king was royalty and in some sense divine. And the people of Israel never did that. They never did that. Why didn't they do that? Because they believed that all humanity was royalty. All humanity was made in the image and likeness of God, not just the king. So when you get to the point in the narrative in the book of Samuel where Israel, the nation of Israel, approach God and say, look, we'd quite like our own king. Like these other nations, they've got their own kings and it looks great. Can we have our own king? And it breaks God's heart. Why would it break God's heart? And the answer is twofold. Firstly, they're basically saying, you know, you're not enough for us. Like, the idea was that God was their king, ruling over them, bringing his kingdom. It's like saying, you're not enough, we want our own king. That breaks God's heart. Secondly, by saying we want a king is to misunderstand their own identity. They have a royal identity. And to place that which is meant to be true of you and just give it to someone else is for you to let go of your true identity before God. You don't need a king because you are royalty. You have a royal identity. So a great example of this would be Psalm 8. Where the psalmist says to God, what is man that you are mindful of him? In other words, what does it mean to be human, to be made in the image and likeness of God? What is the son of man that you care for him? Yet, here's the answer, you've made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him, royal language, crowned him with glory and honor. You've given him dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under his feet. What does it mean to be human, image and likeness of God? It means to be royalty, for God to see you with that sense of value. If the queen, or let's say any member of the royal family came to your house, you'd go all out, wouldn't you? You'd go all out. You wouldn't go to Co-op. You'd go to Waitrose, wouldn't you? And you wouldn't get the sort of cheap things. You'd get the vol-au-vents and the different things. And you'd put on a great spread and you'd have like brilliant ambient music, you know, with a regal touch, whatever that might look like. And you'd make sure that the perfect chair was reserved for the most important guest. And you'd go all out because they're royalty and you want to treat them that way. In the eyes of God, we're all royalty. And we should all treat each other that way. So when we serve people in mission, essentially what we're saying is, you see, in the eyes of God, you're royalty. And we want to make you feel like royalty. That's how God sees you. Here's a story that I think illustrates this well. Mother Teresa, working in the slums of Calcutta amongst the broken and hurting people. You know, literally those that were dying, had nothing to live for. And she's looking after this one beggar on the street that had leprosy. Some limbs had fallen off. He's got sores all over his body. They're becoming infected. There's maggots literally eating away at the infection. And they find him and they take him and take them back to their home where they begin nursing this beggar. And they begin cleaning up the wounds and clearing out the infection, just making him comfortable. And this beggar is dying. Nothing they can do can stop that, but they want to make him comfortable before he dies. And there was a journalist that was just basically observing Mother Teresa's work. And as they get back to the house and they're looking after this beggar, this journalist says to Mother Teresa, can I just talk to you for one moment? Because I've just noticed what you're doing, sort of in another room so no one could hear. I've just noticed that you're caring for this guy and it's amazing. I do feel inspired by it. But it's deeply unstrategic because there's people out there in the slums of Calcutta that if you found them now, they might have a chance at living. This guy's going to die. Nothing you can do can save him. He is dying. But if you left him to die and actually found people that might have a chance of living, you'd be far more effective in your work. And she said, yes, but we want to give dignity to whoever we come across, whether they're living or dying. We want to treat them with incredible dignity. So she said to him, so come back and we're gonna be with this man as he dies. So they wait together for this man to die. And this was the thing that the man said, literally his last words before he died. He said this, looking at Mother Teresa, said, all my life I've lived like a dog, and today I die like a king. All my life I've lived like a dog, and today I die like a king. You see, Mother Teresa knew what it was to engage in mission, to bring dignity to those that were hurting, to treat people like royalty. You see, mission isn't simply about helping people become what they're not already. You know, there's part of that, but equally mission is about helping people come what they already are. They're already sons and daughters of God. We're just trying to reconnect them to their loving Father through the message and ministry of Jesus. They're already, you know, infinitely loved. They just don't know about it. We're trying to reconnect them to the source of love. There's all these things that they already are. They just don't know about it. We're helping people become what they already are. So in Psalm City, in your workplace, it's part of our mission to remind people, you know, your true identity is you're like royalty. In the eyes of God, you're royalty. Do you know how much he cares for you? How much he'd do for you? How much he'd suffer for you? That's how passionate he is about you. To engage in mission, not just in word, but indeed is to communicate that somehow to people. So when we're fixing up someone's garden, that's what we're saying. You're like royalty to God, and we're going to treat you like that. Here's the third thing. Image and likeness is the language of representation. This is the final one, don't worry. Image and likeness is the language of representation. So in the ancient Near East, every king would reign over their territory, and there'd be some remote parts of their territory that they couldn't visit that often. And in those remote parts, they'd put up a statue of the king. And the statue would remind people, this is your king, he reigns over you, you need to respect him. Now, that king, or the statue, was considered a complete representation of the king. So if you were to deface the statue, that was considered exactly the same as attacking the king himself in person, punishable by death. If you were to spit at the statue, that was seen as exactly the same as spitting at the king himself. So you couldn't sort of like distinguish the statue from that which it represents, in other words, the king. Again, what does that have to do with mission? What's that got to do with us engaging in mission? Simply this: what we do to our fellow humanity, we do to God. What we do to our fellow humanity, we do to God. That's a frightening thought, by the way. Like, I don't know about you, but when I think about that, it kind of terrifies me, because I know how I treat people some of the time. So Proverbs 14, verse 31 puts it like this: whoever oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God. When you mistreat the poor, you mistreat the person they're made in the image of God, and that is God. In Matthew 25, Jesus says something very similar. He says to some of his followers, he said, look, do you remember, like, I was hungry and you fed me, and I was naked and you clothed me, I was in prison and you came to visit me? And they kind of like interject and say, hang on a minute, we don't remember you being in prison. And like you fed us. That was the feeding of the 5,000. I don't remember us feeding you. And when were you naked? I'm sure we'd remember that. Like, I don't remember clothing you. And Jesus says, no, don't you get it? When you did it for the least of my brothers and sisters, that's when you did it for me. When you found someone that was naked and clothed, you did it for me, because they're made in my image. When you visited someone in prison that was lonely, you did it for me, because they're made in my image. When you do it for the least of these, you do it for me. 1 John 3 says something very similar. Let me read it to you very quickly. It says this: this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Like, he goes on to say, it doesn't make any sense to say you hate your brother who's made in the image and likeness of God, yet you love God. Like, the two actually don't go together. Another example would be the Great Commandment, where Jesus says, the Great Commandment is this, it's in two parts. First part, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second part is like the first one, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, I've read that hundreds of times, and the question I've always had is like, in what way is the second one like the first? Like, they both have the word love in it, great. But, like, in what other sense is the second commandment like the first commandment? And I think the answer is, to love your neighbour who's made in the image and likeness of God is to love God. To love your neighbour made in the image and likeness of God is to love God. So when we serve people in the Bempton Estate, when we love people in our workplaces, in our own communities, essentially that's part of our love for God. It's part of our worship. So, final question. So what? Like, we know three new truths. That to be made in the image and likeness of God means to be his sons and daughters, means to have a royal identity, it means that we represent God. Like, what difference does that make in terms of our mission? Like, how do we go about conveying these life-changing truths to people who don't know them? And here's the very, very simple answer. It's painfully simple. We communicate it through friendship. Like, that's it. We communicate it through friendship. So if you look at John chapter 1, the story of God taking on flesh, it says, the Word, talking about God, became flesh and dwelt among us. The Greek word for dwelling literally means to pitch a tent. So essentially it says, God took on human flesh and just pitched a tent in our midst. Like, what does that mean? It means he just came to hang out with us, to build friendships with us. You know, if you read through the Gospels, pretty much most of it is Jesus extending invitation to people, like his followers. Like, come, leave those nets, come follow me, come be my mate. And hang out with me. You know, Zacchaeus, come down from that tree. What are you doing up there? You look completely stupid. Come down, let's go and have some dinner. Levi, tax collector, like, everyone hates you because you're ripping them off. Let's go and have some dinner and hang out. You know, the lady at the well, let's just enter a conversation where I can hear more of your heart. Jesus makes a phenomenal amount of friends, and in the friendship shares something of himself. Like, it's painfully straightforward. A lot of mission is just making good friends. And because we overlook that in the church, sometimes we're not very good at mission. So here's how Paul defines his missionary strategy. This is the Apostle Paul, rather than Paul, sorry, although that would be interesting too. The Apostle Paul says this: though I am free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. Just pause there. Now, it's easy to read this and think, is Paul like being completely inauthentic? Is he basically saying I'm faking it? They don't even know that I'm under the law, but they think I am, you know, just so I can get to share this message with them. No, he's not being inauthentic. When he says I became like one of them, it's like I became one of them. I just started hanging out with them. I wasn't under the law, they were, but I was just with them. I pitched my tent amongst them, started hanging out. We became friends. They thought I was one of the crowd. He goes on, to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. I don't know, it's getting confusing in the language. But the point is, to those not having the law, Paul became one of them, started hanging out with them. He wasn't being inauthentic. He had the law of Christ, but he became one with them relationally. He goes on, to the weak, I became the weak to win the weak. I've become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. Just make a lot of friends. I'm making lots and lots of friends. In the context of friendship, I'm sharing my life and what God's done for me and the message of the cross and all that God longs for your life. I just begin to share it because it makes sense in the context of relationship. You know, mission is about friendship making. So here's two thoughts as we land. Soul in the City is about friendship making. We want to do someone's garden, don't we? Great. We want to decorate the home of the elderly. Brilliant. We want to play football with some of the kids there. All of it's brilliant, and I'm going to love it. But it's more than that. It's about friendship. It's about investing yourself in someone's life. So when the garden deteriorates because there isn't a group decorating it or gardening it again, the friendship remains. So that maybe as you're gardening, you're asking the elderly person, hey, like, tell me, like, where did you grow up? And like, how did you end up here? And you hear about their life and suddenly there's a friendship that's formed. And when Soul in the City is over, you can say, look, we should meet up again. Do you fancy doing coffee? Like, there's so many stories of friendships that formed last year at Soul in the City that now, the Clasper is a great example, visit the elderly all over the estate just because they met them through gardening projects. And now they're sharing their lives and stuff about the church because there's a friendship that has formed. Soul in the City is about friendship making. So my encouragement, if you haven't signed up, sign up. And if you have signed up, rock up on Thursday, Friday and Saturday ready to make some great friends. So serve your heart out gardening and playing football, but make friends. Like, ask people about their stories. That's how mission begins to flourish when we make great friends. Here's the second thing then. There's a book called The Art of Neighbouring, which is written by a guy called Jay Pathak, who spoke here a few years ago. And he basically says it's easy to talk about changing the world. You know, as Christians, we love doing this stuff, basically going really big. No one talks about like just changing the sort of like street around them. Oh, there's a litter problem. I want to bring about transformation in this area because of the litter. No one talks like that. They go really big, don't they? We're going to change like situations globally. And he said, like, it feels sometimes inauthentic to go that big when you're not even being an agent of transformation right where you live. Like, to go all out on the global or universal or whatever just doesn't ring true when you're not transforming anything locally. So he said, look, what about this? What if Christians grab hold of this? This is your house. Hopefully it looks a little bit nicer than that. But that is you. Now, this are the eight people that you live closest to. So when I say close, I don't mean relationally close, I mean proximity. Who are the eight nearest people to you in terms of where you live? Some of you, this might be your actual scenario. This guy or girl is the flat above you. This person's the flat below. To your right, to your left, and these ones are the ones diagonally opposite you. So there's eight boxes around you. These are your neighbours. Now, he asked three questions to see if you're actually making any difference locally. Not globally or nationally, just locally on your street. Tell me the names of those eight people. Tell me the names of those eight people. Some of you might be really good at this. I was awful. And as I did it, I was like, oh, I don't know many of their names. So it was hard to talk about transforming a city or a nation when you don't even know the names of the eight people you live closest to. Second question, tell me something about their life, some facts. Tell me what they do for a living. Tell me where they grew up. And again, I've done this activity with loads of Christians. They're like, don't know. Like, you haven't even asked them what they do for a living or where they grew up? I'm like, no. Third question, tell me something about their longings in life or what they're going through right now. Like, have they just been through a messy divorce and are hurting? Have they lost a loved one recently and you know, battling with depression? Have they just got their dream job and are so excited? Have they just had a baby and they're going through all of that? Like, how are they doing right now? Pick one of the eight. Just answer the question, do you know how they're doing right now? Have you asked them, how are you doing right now? And the reality is, and I'm not pointing the finger because it was embarrassing when I did this exercise. But if we want to be agents of change, not just globally, nationally, of our city, but literally of our street, we've got to be able to answer these questions. And that's what Soul in the City is essentially about. We're making friends. Because when you make friends, you won't let them live in squalor. You won't let them grieve alone. You won't let them live in isolation. Because they're brother and sister. They're your friends. And you'll want to step in. So let's grab hold of these three things as we engage in mission, whether it be workplace or Soul in the City. To be human means to be a son and daughter of God. God cares about his kids. And if we can grab God's heart for those around us, it will transform our mission. Secondly, humanity have a royal identity. Some people feel, in terms of their identity, like a piece of crap. And that shouldn't be okay with us. We should be trying to communicate in whatever way possible. You're royalty in the eyes of God. He cares passionately about you. Thirdly, they reflect their maker. And if we can go about our mission remembering these things, maybe it might shape how we share our lives and share our faith. So let's stand together.